meeting is now being recorded.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome, everyone, to the new GTLD Subsequent Procedures Subteam Track 2 Legal Regulatory Issues held on the 25th of May, 2017. In the interest of time, there will be no roll call. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect room. If you are only on the audio bridge, could you please let yourself be known now? Thank you. Hearing no names, I would like to remind all participants to please state your name before speaking for recording purposes and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid background noise. With this, I will turn it over to Phil Buckingham. Please begin.
Good morning. It's actually Michael Fleming here. But thank you very much, Julie. So welcome, everyone, to this special series of Working Track 2 calls. This is the second meeting in a week we've had. Just to kind of pick up and make sure that we can go through all the necessary material that before the Gilbert meeting and June. We will have another meeting next week and then a meeting 2 weeks after that. I just would like to say thank you very much for attending this. Moving on to our second order of business, the SOIs, does anybody have an SOI that has been updated that they would wish to share with the group? No? All right, then I will move on to our first topic. Phil, it looks like you kind of dropped, so actually let's do contractual compliance first. Could we get those slides brought up? Oh, perfect. Thank you very much. Okay, could I get, could we perhaps maybe unsync these or would, oh, perfect. All right. So just kind of to explain on this one, basically, the contractual compliance is an issue that isn't going to, that we're not going to dwell into too deeply. To be very blunt, the base agreement and also the registry agreement have contractual compliance where registries need to meet them. Principle E and Recommendation 17 from the final report provide the foundation for how contractual compliance mechanisms relate to registries. And there is the Section 5.4.2 of the Applicant Guidebook that also explain this. ICANN's contractual compliance perform audits on a regular basis to ensure that GTLD registry operators remain in compliance with agreement obligations, as well as investigate any complaints from the community regarding the registry operator's adherence to its contractual obligations. Moving on to the next slide. So basically, there's not a lot of deep issues that we need to go over on this. Seeing how the discussion group did not find any specific concerns. However, this is something that we may wish to talk about. Now, contractual compliance is something that is more of an implementation issue itself. Therefore, we're not going to be able to change it from the whole. However, the PDP is able to provide recommendations for the future and how this may provide recommendations perhaps how to better contractual compliance. Now, some issues that were found were within the comments that were raised in public comments. A lot of the questions actually had to deal with the relation between the application for the new GTLD itself as well as the the registry agreement. I'm just going to read some of these questions that were raised. Was how How much can one rely on representations made in an application? Were representations integrated into the signed registry agreement enough to be enforceable? Impact of change requests? This question touches the other topic areas, such as application submission, evaluation, and contracting processes. Now, within we actually already submitted, I think this question was raised in our community comment too, when we submitted that out for public comment here, and I think that just ended the other day. What we're going to be, well, I think we have a lot of feedback there. I did see some of the preparatory answers from a few of the places, organizations that were trying, that wanted to submit answers, and it looks like we'll be able to get some good feedback there. So I'm just going to move on to the next slide. Specific relevant guidance in regards to this, I'm just going to read this out for the sake of those that are on the audio bridge only. So the principle E from the original policy was a set of operational criteria must be set out in contractual conditions in the registry agreement to ensure compliance with ICANN policies. And recommendation 17 read, A clear compliance and sanctions process must be set out in the base contract, which could lead to contract termination. And MRA is kind enough to have copied the question that we the question that was put into CC2 into the chat for us. Thank you very much, Emily. And as soon as I finish the slides, we only have one more. I'll go ahead and read that question. But actually, the last slide is actually just the rationale for policy development, mentioning what I already mentioned. Reads what I already mentioned, which was basically that as a policy development, we do not have, it is not within our mandate to make changes to this unless they would be in the form of recommendations for how to further implement in the future. But the question Emily did post that we put in CC2 was that knowing that the role of contractual compliance is to enforce the registry agreement and any changes to the RAT role are beyond the scope of this PDP, the working group is not anticipating policy development related to this topic. The working group expects that any new contractual compliance be made enforceable by inclusion in the base agreement. Do you agree with this approach? I think there was one more question that talked about making changes to what was the question specifically? I think it was talking about asking whether or not the intent of the application itself should be reflected, or should the application itself be reflected into, be tied into the registry agreement. I think there was another question that talked about that. That was in the registry agreement area. I think it was probably towards the last section 2.1.4 or 5, maybe, I want to say. I can't remember off the top of my head. But I think that question will relate a lot more with what we're dealing with here. So I'd kind of like to open the floor for discussion on this. Does the group want to further talk about this further? Would the group like to raise a few concerns that they have with contractual compliance, and perhaps are there some recommendations that we can talk about? One of the things that I think might be helpful, and I'm going to go back here to the third slide, the questions that were raised in the public comments, I think, are of interest here, because this is what originally the discussion group found as at least the foundation for the reasoning for why we should even consider this. And what I asked staff, and I'm not sure if they'll be able to discuss this, but I'm not sure if they'll be able to bring it up, but if they were able to find those public comments that talked about this. And Greg, I see your hand. I'm just going to read the question really quick that we did talk about, that we did put into the registry agreement. So just bear with me one moment. So, Steve, I think you have the right question. The question is from 2.1.3 of the CC2. It asks, should the application be incorporated into the signed registry agreement? Should portions of the application explicitly identified be incorporated into the signed registry agreement? If changes are made between applying and executing the registry agreement, how should this be handled? If changes are made after executing the registry agreement, how should this be handled? If changes like these are contemplated, how can the needs of the community to properly consider the contents of an application be weighed against an applicant's need to make either minor adjustments or fundamental changes to their registry? All right, then, Greg, I'm going to go ahead and open the floor for discussion. You have the mic.
Thanks, Greg Chatton, for the record. In a sense, I'm not sure where to start. There are, you know, so many issues that arise with relationship to contractual compliance, and obviously the view of contracted parties is going to be very different than that of non-contracted parties, but we all have our issues. I guess the question isn't so much, you know, are there any issues with contractual compliance, but really what is the scope and mandate of this group reasonably with regard to those issues? And maybe another way to look at it is, you know, which of those issues have to do with policy? Obviously, you know, one issue that is near and dear to my heart, abuse reporting and investigation and that whole thing. You know, there are a number of different efforts to try to resolve the fact that the agreement itself is incredibly high level and not too instructive about how it should be complied with. You know, that's on the registrar side. The registry side has, you know, a different issue. I think these are questions that have been raised and have been raised in public comments that the IPC has submitted. So I think I'm just concerned that we can't just kind of brush by contractual compliance issues unless we decide exactly what it is that we're kind of brushing by. Because if this is an opportunity to examine these things, and, you know, I'm looking for, you know, resolutions, obviously, in the multi-stakeholder model that is driven and that, you know, resolve issues in a way that everyone can live with. Just don't want to find ourselves somehow 6 weeks now or 6 months from now wondering how come we never did anything about this. Thanks.
Thank you, Greg. I think that that's a great idea. If we need to talk, there are certain issues in regards that we need to raise that are a bit higher than others, and we should put that at the forefront. Okay, I've got Alan Greenberg, and then I've got Aubrey Dory on the mic. So, Alan, go ahead. You have the floor.
Thank you very much. 2 points in relation to compliance. The first is the question that was posed, the 2.1.3. I think the answer to that is going to, I personally think the answer should be yes, we should include everything. But it becomes far more relevant if we end up having categories in future applications with significantly different terms associated with them, and presumably the lack of ability of the registry to change those terms once they've gone through. So if we give preferential treatment, for instance, to community applications, you can't have the registry immediately say, oh, by the way, I'm not a community application anymore. So the answer is going to end up being nuanced by how we decide other things. In terms of what is within our scope and mandate as a PDP, you're correct that we can, you know, if we feel that registries or registrars have to do something which is then subject to compliance, we can, that's certainly within our full ability to do. But the other thing that is within our ability to do is a recommendation to ICANN in terms of how to enforce things. In other words, if we were to find that as a purely hypothetical, ICANN didn't staff up compliance and wasn't geared up for the 1,000 new TLDs that suddenly showed up on their doorstep. It is within our mandate to recommend to the ICANN organization, the new term, that it treat compliance differently. And that has nothing to do with what legally they are allowed to enforce, but does have to do with their operation and how effectively they do their job. Thank you.
Thank you, Al. And yes, I do agree that we definitely have the ability to provide the recommendations to ICANN. Aubrey, why don't you go ahead? You have them.
Okay, thank you. Aubrey speaking. And in looking at this, and this is me speaking personally, not with a co-chair hat on, from a personal perspective, I think that the contracts that people have do need to insulate, enforce the conditions under which a name was won. So whether it's all or part, but part of the problem I have getting there is really looking at audits and compliance as a black box, is having no real idea what they're finding now and seeing any sort of real data about what is going on in registry and registrar compliance audits and such. Excuse me. And I know that's where there were recommendations that more data be collected, more data be made visible. And so I'm wondering also how we couple in some of these things together so that, yes, we're talking about what they need to be complied with, but what needs to be complied with, but also how it's measured, how it's audited, how it's recorded and made transparent. So I think they're both important, and I think they may somewhat go together. So I just wanted to sort of put that out there. Thanks.
Thank you, Aubrey. So I think we're all talking in the general same direction here. I hear Greg talking about figuring out what issues specifically we need to be looking at. The issue that he raised specifically was about what do we need to, sorry, I'm trying to scroll up here. We need to be figuring out exactly what we're going to be brushing by, but more so what we're going to be talking about within this specific topic. And I think that Greg's concerns were in the area of what kind of data ICANN might be collecting in regards to how they enforce the contracts with the contracted parties. And Alan mentioned that we should be able to make those recommendations towards ICANN as well. And then I believe, Aubrey, you were in a similar area about basically things being kind of a black box there, and that the recommendations that perhaps we should be driving is for data to be on a clearer level of what they're collecting. Greg, go ahead. I'm sorry if I might have misstated what you stated, but if I'm wrong, please correct me.
Greg Shatton, for the record. While data is a concern, communication and transparency regarding closure of cases and things like that, my concern goes beyond just the data element and to the actual element of what they're charged, how they do what they do, how effective they are. As Alvary said, Alan said, if they're not well-staffed, they can't do what they're supposed to do. We need to tell them how. We may need to give recommendations how to do it. So, data is a window into something, and it's the something that I'm really more concerned about than the data. Although the data, we need the data too to know what the heck is going on.
All right, thank you, Greg. So, I'm feeling that we're in a general direction about basically how ICANN conducts compliance. I'm feeling that this is the area that individuals would like more information on, and well, perhaps that data, how data is collected, and specifically what data can be provided, would be an area that we might want to make a recommendation on. Do we have a general consensus on this? And I'm sorry, Annabeth, you also had a very important question as well. I'm just going to read that out loud to the individuals only on audio. So Annabeth Lang put in, is this also a question about entering into a contract between ICANN and a registry under certain conditions? And then after the delegation in the registry changes the policy considerably. This was relevant in the first round in connection with, for example, community TLDs or certain geographical TLDs that needed support from a public authority. Post-delegation was on the table in the first round. So, yes, I do believe that this is something that relates with that and how we kind of talked about that within the application. For a TLD entering through a contract with ICANN and then changed it, after that, I'd actually really like to explore evidence. I'd like to explore if there have been any cases of that happening, and then discussing potentially how ICANN went through with that. That would be something that we might want to ask ICANN for. So are there any other further hands on this, or would anyone else like to discuss this? If not, I'm going to just briefly wanted to mention that the public comments that were brought up in regards to this are on the screen. Looks like there were about two comments, one from the IPC stating that INTA is contracted that it's concerned that the DG did not identify any specific issues with respect to contractual compliance in light of the number of troubling operational practices engaged in by registry operators during the first DGTLD round. These practices include arbitrary and abusive pricing for premium domains, targeting trademarks, use of reserve names to circumvent Sunrise and operating launch programs that differed materially from what was approved by ICANN. These troubling practices seem to violate the spirit, if not the letter, of various contractual obligations in the registry agreement. So this is another area that we should bring to our forefront. And then the BC also stated, concerns about premium pricing and predatory pricing were identified by the BC, but ICANN did not consider this a compliance issue. We recommend requiring a registry operators to include a detailed description of their proposed Sunrise and premium pricing programs in their applications. So I hear premium pricing and predatory pricing. Basically, I hear pricing concern that such maneuvers or such methods by registries were kind of used to abuse the pre-decided launch programs such as Sunrise that gave exclusive rights to trademark holders, or sorry, it gave priority to trademark holders. Would anyone else like to raise a comment on this? Move on to TLD rollout in about 4 minutes, but if anyone would like to reflect on the concerns of premium pricing and how registries. Okay, Jeff, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. This is Jeff Newman. It was just a comment on what was just said in the comments from INTA. I think I certainly agree that there are issues with predatory pricing that we need to examine, but I want to disassociate that with the comment that says that pricing should be disclosed in the application. I think that, that's If you look at when the applications were in this last round versus when the launch was to market, asking someone to set forth definitive pricing before they even know if they're going to get the TLD and what the market conditions are going to be and, anything like that, I think that's not very reasonable to ask. But that said, I do think that we should take some of the concerns on predatory pricing and figure out ways that we can address those concerns. I'm just not, I don't believe that setting it forth in the application is realistic from a registry perspective. Thanks.
Thank you, Jeff. My interpretation of that comment, I don't think was specifically one of them to put pricing, what the pricing would be into the application. But I can definitely agree that having something like that isn't necessarily fair to the registry, is noting that is kind of a, it's, you don't want your competition reading exactly how you're going to be doing your premium pricing. Jeff, did you want to reply to what I just said, or are you good to drop your hand?
Sorry, this is Jeff. I think it was not INTA, it was the BC. Sorry, it's that statement the BC says, which says, we recommend requiring registry operators to include a detailed description of their pricing, of their proposed Sunrise and premium pricing programs in their application. So that's really what I was making a comment on.
Yes.
But I agree with the notion of having to address predatory pricing, but that would also potentially require a recommendation from the PDP, and I'm not saying I'm for this or against it. I'm just saying it would necessitate a finding that pricing was within the jurisdiction of ICANN in general. So that's not something that we've come to any sort of consensus on. And sorry, this is my personal opinion, not as chair. I should have said that at the outset. Thanks.
Thank you, Jeff. And I just want to correct myself, stating that the first comment wasn't from INTA directly, but was a reference to INTA on behalf of the IPC. Thank you. Steve, you have your hand up.
Thanks, Michael. This is Steve Chan from staff. And I just wanted to note that some of these concerns that are related and in these comments, they weren't, they weren't reflected in the section on contractual compliance in the issue report. So, for instance, I believe the pricing aspects were captured under the registry agreement. So I think the logic was that if there's something to be enforced related to premium pricing, it needs to be captured in the agreement. It would not be within contractual compliance's abilities or purview to be able to enforce something that's not captured in the agreement. So I guess I wanted to try to separate some of the issues that are raised here from the topic that we're talking about right now, which is contractual compliance. Hopefully that makes sense. Thanks.
All right, thank you, Steve. I think we're actually ready to move on here. We have to talk about TLD rollout today as well. Phil, are you prepared to discuss this?
Hi, Michael. I guess so. I haven't done much preparation work, as you gather. But I certainly worked my way through the slides, and we'll take it from there and sort of start posing some questions and get the thought process is going on this one.
So you sound a little bit muffled. Could you
speak
a little bit?
Is that better? Hello?
Is that better, everyone? Jeff, is that better?
Sorry, there's nothing I can do about it.
Just quiet. Might I just maybe go through this one, or would you like to at least go through the slides?
I don't mind reading off the slides. I don't know if Steve, Emily, whether you've got the, can you bring up the stats from ICANN's site? And we could kind of have a look at those, because that would be kind of interesting.
Let's introduce the topic on with the slides first, and then have a look at the stats after.
Okay. Well, if you can get here we go. So I'll read off what we've got on the screen here. And explanation of the subject here. I guess everybody can hear me. I'll try and speak up as loud as I can here. So implementation guideline 1 in the 2007 final report talks about domain squatting. I guess we need to discuss what that means, domain squatting, stating that a delegated string should be used within a fixed time period. In the African guidebook, the spirit of this guidance is captured in both contracting and delegation. According to section 5.1, applicants who have completed the evaluation process
are
expected. Yeah, hello? Can you hear me okay, everybody?
I'm getting comments that it's really difficult to hear.
Yeah, sorry. Do you want to take over?
Do you mind if I just go through the slides really quick?
I'm shouting in my phone here. Seriously. It's the reception error I'm in. Yeah. Shall I play on?
Yeah, why don't I just go through the slides really quick, and then if you, there are any comments in the chat, would you let me know?
Yeah, sure, of course. Okay, Mike.
Perfect, thank you. I'm sorry, thank you. All right, okay, so I'm just going to go through the slides really quick, everyone. And I had some comments from individuals that I was I was a little bit loud myself. Can everybody hear me on a better volume now? I turned the volume about, put the volume about halfway. Yes. I'm getting a thumbs up. All right. So we get the ball rolling? All right, let's go. Okay, so expletionives, basically to kind of introduce on TLD rollout, just need to prepare myself now. The applicant guidebook did talk about TLD rollout. Basically, this was more so how soon a TLD needed to be up to speed and needed to be actually delegated. According to 5.1 of the applicant guidebook, applicants had to complete the evaluation process and also execute their registry agreement within 9 months. They needed to complete applicants that have completed the evaluation process need to execute the registry agreement within 9 months. And there also was another deadline that registries needed to follow, and that was put into Article 4.3.B of the basic agreement. After execution of the registry agreement, applicants were expected to delegate within 12 months of the effective date. So the main question that is being raised here was that whether or not this was adequate time allowed for the rollout of TLDs, noting that upon delegation of the TLD to the registry operator, recurring registry level fees are due to be paid to ICANN. Yes, Emily, thank you. We are on slide 3. Apologies for those that I might be going a little bit fast, but it'd be beneficial to discuss and see if there isn't research that we might be able to look into in regards to this. And then the implementation guideline 1 here from the final report, from the original policy said that an applicant granted a TLD must use it within a fixed time frame, which will be specified in the application process. And on our last slide, it states here that the issue report noted that the working group may want to collect data input to determine the degree of concern related to delegation timeline requirements. We do have a question on this in the CC2, so those responses will help to look at this. I do want to note that further information that is not in these slides, that's just to kind of help inform everyone, but in reality, actually, in regards to the delegation timeline, ICANN did issue notices to individuals that needed to complete the registry agreement or execute the registry agreement. I believe it was in about August 2014, I believe the statement was made. But basically, this was specifically in regards to, I would like to say it's more so in regards to applicants that were looking to apply as brand TLDs, because applicants looking to apply for brand TLDs and largely largely in part thanks to the efforts of the BRG. The specification 13 that kind of defined what a brand TLD was wasn't finished until, I believe, the part, again, later part of 2014, somewhere around that time. But the point here is that an extension request was offered to those applicants, and they had to apply before, I think, a cutoff date of September 24th. I could be wrong, Trang. You're better on this subject than me. But basically, an extension to execute the registry agreement was then offered for an additional 9 months. That was one of the extensions that was granted in regards to the deadline you have here. And then there is another aspect that I think that would be helpful to explore, and that would be ask ICANN in regards to the delegation deadline. If any applicants the extension was given to Spec 13 applicants because of the time it did take to file. And sorry, I wanted to convey that in my explanation, but I guess it didn't provide too much. Sorry, I guess that wasn't conveyed well enough, but still, that was the reasoning in regards to that extension itself. It's not to say that they had an advantage or something like that. It is to say that they had new contractual areas to consider before moving forward with their own agreements. And I'm just trying to put this out there to make sure individuals are aware of what extensions were provided. I wanted to see if it wouldn't help to ask ICANN in regards to the delegation deadline that was in the 4.3.2, I believe, of the applicant guidebook. Of the registry agreement. 4.3.B. But were there any TLDs? First of all, the first question would be, were there any TLDs that did request an extension to the delegation deadline? How many of those were granted? How many of those were denied? And were any TLDs terminated due to not meeting the delegation deadline? I think that there were a few that were terminated on behalf of ICANN, but I'd like to get specific input in regards to that. Now, I do want to say that the terms for applying for an extension to either of those would be to either the contracting deadline and also the delegation deadline was that the TLD or the applicant needed to be show that they were working in good faith towards completing either of those. And Jeff has his hand raised, so I'm just gonna let him go.
Yeah, thanks. This is Jeff. Sorry, there's some thunder in the background, so if you hear that, I apologize. I think the question around this was not just really about timelines, because those are what they are, and I'm not sure there's a huge issue with whether it should be 12 months or 15 months or, you know. I think the issue here was, did the delegation requirement within a year, did that actually achieve the goal that we wanted to prevent squatting on TLDs or people? I mean, I'm not even sure what the goal was, but to the extent if that was the goal, I will note that there were many TLDs that were sold after delegation, because after all, delegation only means having the NIC page up, which, you know, and a couple policies thrown up there and a who is page, which was usually, you know, it's like nothing. So, I'm not even sure what purpose the delegation deadline actually serves right now. And so I wanted to kind of talk about that aspect more so than the timing as to whether, you know, a year was enough or, you know, not enough. I think that we need to go back to the principle, which is that we wanted TLDs to be used when they were applied for. And again, I don't know if that's still something we all want, but that was something that the GNSO wanted back in 2007-2008 timeframe. So I think that's, before we talk about the timelines, we should talk about what we're trying to achieve. Thanks.
So, Jeff, to kind of reply to that, thank you. The implementation guideline one within the 2007 final report did seek to prevent domain squatting. that is why we had the fixed time frame. And to reply on whether or not it did achieve what it wanted to achieve, I think there was a blog post, and I don't know what date it was posted because there's no date on the blog post itself, that stated ICANN had about in spite of the delegation deadline being within such and such registry agreement, that there were about 200 TLDs that still were not delegated. And I think, if I remember correctly, July 2016 was the cutoff date for a lot of them. And I think that it would be helpful to see from what we can see is that there were TLDs that weren't delegating. Was this an issue? Basically, when you delegate, you need to start. From heavens to Betsy, I can't remember. Is it when you delegate, you have to start paying ICANN fees, or is it when you start paying your registry level fees, or is it when you sign a registry agreement? It's so early in the morning, I can't remember. That is a very important aspect to consider. Delegation, that's what I thought, yeah. So when it's delegation, at that point you need to start paying those fees, and I think that's one of the big things there, is that part of the domain squatting, for example, and is that a concern that we should be raising? I feel like I might be taken out to the shooting gallery if I say this, but I think some of the concerns were also in relation to some applicants that were brands, rather than using the TLD, applied for it in order to, yes, the blog post was written by Christine Willits on April 16th. Thank you very much. Phil, do you know the year? Probably 2015, I think. 15, thank you. And so, yes, I think that was the belief of a lot of individuals that brand TLDs wanted to apply for the TLD for just defense purposes so that nobody else could apply for it. And that was one of the areas or one of the that might have been one of the fears of domain squatting, them not using it. But that is a whole different ballgame, and I'm not going to open that up. I will let anybody else raise their hands on this issue. So let's talk about this. We have 15 more minutes. Does anybody want to talk about whether or not this is an issue? And was a year enough? Jeff, I think it is important to address that. But was there a lot of domain squatting, for example, that might have happened? Was there evidence of domain squatting? Was a year enough? Was the way in which both of these were set, is there anything we need to discuss in regards to this? So, Greg, you have your hand up. Please go ahead.
Sure. This is Greg, perhaps exemplifying the saying that fools rush in or angels fear to tread, but to my mind, the issue of use and rollout timing, and I see Jeff Newman's question in there. Obviously, there's a lot of downstream issues, but to my mind, there's clearly a policy consideration and even a public policy consideration that TLDs, in a sense, are more like spectrum than they are like then second level domains, which now could be seen as infinite in many ways, or at least a lot less finite than top level domains. And ICANN has the public interest obligation, and the interest in doing this is not just to kind of let everybody sell a whole bunch of second-level domains. There's ideas of innovation and competition, and there's no innovation and competition in an unused top-level domain. So I think there are lots of different justifications for not allowing the warehousing of top-level domains. Thanks.
Thank you, Greg. Alan, you have the mic right after Greg. Again, please.
Thank you very much. I find this exceedingly frustrating. There was a policy in place, as we've been told repeatedly, if we can't find a justification for changing it, it stays in place. And I find having these kind of discussions where there clearly is data available, it is not, I would not think it's particularly sensitive, and yet we're almost acting as if it's something we can't ask for. I think we should shelve any of these discussions where we need data, identify the data, and ask for it and expect it to come quickly, unless there's some real major competition reason why it can't. We need to have informed discussions, and I find we're going round in circles in this discussion right now. Thank you.
Alan, I'm sorry, could you specify what data specifically you'd
be
looking at?
Sure, we've asked, I've heard the question raised several times here, well, have there been people who had to have an extension? Were there ones that were terminated because they didn't deploy them within the right time frame? Those kind of things I think they're important to understand, and I don't have any feel for what the answers are to them.
Thank you, Alan. So I do agree that is data that we should get, I think we should get an official response on that. I do think that there's a blog post, thanks to Kevin Murphy, that talked about TLDs that did get, terminated on behalf of ICANN. But I would like to request that data specifically to ICANN. So I guess I would put that as an action item for us to look at. Samantha, please go ahead.
Hello?
Hello, we can hear you.
Can you guys hear me at all?
Samantha, we can hear you. Can you hear us? Okay, so Samantha, we were able to hear you. If you want to get back on the mic and just talk, you might not be able to hear us.
Oh, so we're good on the sound front?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. Sorry about that. I was just having a little bit of a connection issue. So I agree that we should get the official data count from ICANN or whoever it is. I think off the cuff, I can probably say that there weren't a lot of TLDs that got denied or terminated because they didn't delegate on time. I think most of the people who launched TLDs with the intention of using them launched them pretty quickly. And I actually think I would like to go back to the question that Jeff raised, because I think it's potentially the more interesting one, which is, how do we want to define using a TLD? Because I think this point was brought up earlier. There are a lot, especially a lot of dot brands out there, who just have a NIC page up, and they met the delegation deadline, so per the old policy, they met this quote-unquote use guideline, but they're really not being used. There aren't multiple domains under these TLDs. The companies in question aren't really using them for anything. So I actually think it would be an interesting topic of conversation or road to go down to answer that question that Jeff raised earlier.
Thank you, Samantha. And I'm going to take my co-chair hat off for a second and kind of reply to this definition of use aspect. But I'd like to kind of ask, what is the concern with putting those TLDs that are not actively using it on the spot? I mean, I can understand. I mean, they went through the process to apply for the TLD. They're paying the relative ICANN fees, and they are moved, they are out there. But sure, I can understand that having a NIC page up there isn't a very widespread use. But at the same time, some of those TLDs are not necessarily in the goal to actively use it. And yes, some of them are there for to defend their, and I am talking about brand TLDs that aren't really gung ho about using the TLD. They did spend a lot of money to defend their, to basically keep their mark protected on the top level. And I know this is a very deep discussion, but I'd kind of like to discuss what the concerns around that specifically are, and see if there is actual need to even open up that can. Greg, you have your hand raised as well. I'm just going to move on.
Thanks, Greg Chatton, for the record. I don't want anyone to think that because I raised some points about why TLD should be used that I was advocating a strong use-it-or-lose-it position. There are also many good reasons why it may take quite some time for a TLD to be used, and Jeff has cited some in the, some of the, and Rubens as well as talking about them in the chat. We could go down that road as well. And, I think one of the concerns, and especially you bring it up with regard to dot brands, as was just brought up, dot brands entered this to some extent with a feeling like they had a, or I should say brands entered this feeling like they had somewhat of a gun to their head. And that, that they better, because this was a black box type of process where nobody knew who else was applying until it was too late to apply, for competitive reasons, people wanted to get in, for defensive reasons, people wanted to make sure that they got in for reasons that, sometimes there are shared trademarks and you wanted to make sure that your other brand owners of the same brand, didn't get in and, without you being there too. Which means that in a lot of cases the brands didn't have the commercial motivations in place. And then it becomes an issue of finding the budget and the time and changes inside a business when something takes 5 years to go from point A to point B. People who own the project may no longer even be there. There's just a lot of good reasons why, particularly why I think, brands have ended up, even brands that are working hard to get on that have sophisticated ideas, this are taking a long time to do it. So there's no right time or wrong time for use to be too long. In a sense, if somebody has a five-year plan to get their TLD up and it's a good plan and it's going to be a good TLD, there's no problem with that. It's really kind of the warehousing and lack of competition or innovation that's a question. But at the same time, if you're going to ask people to pony up a couple of $100,000 and then double that or more in secondary fees and costs, you can't just say, sorry, you didn't think of something good to use it with. I mean, maybe there'll be that'll help some people get to market, but to my mind, it just seems like one more unnecessary and arbitrary action being taken against registries. Thanks.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you very much. That was a good point, and Rubens also raised a good point about has the CCTRT looked into this angle. I do want to kind of bring the ball home a little bit, though. I think that we're getting into an area that might not be specifically what we're talking about, what we need to be talking about. Well, it's really good discussion. We're talking about specifically in regards to TLD rollout, and while the use discussion does relate in the fact of whether or not there should be perhaps should we define usage? Should we have a deadline on how soon a TLD should be used? Discussion. I think that. There's reasons why there is not a specific delegation, there's not a specific deadline on that itself, because my point is that the same fees are being paid by those TLDs that are not actively using it, using the TLD to ICANN. So they're paying their way, they're just not using it. And I can understand the frustration of people that they're not using a valuable resource, and that we also need to consider the fact that they are paying those fees, and what they want to do with that is what they want to, is their own right, because they've gone through the same hurdles we all have. Aubrey provided a good comment. It may be necessary to amend a strict policy with a list of possible circumstances for getting an extension. I agree with that as well. I'd like to talk about the, well, not today, since we are running late on time, but if it was of interest to other individuals, I'd kind of like to open the bucket and, oh, sorry, open the can in regards to the good faith argument in applying for an extension, because that was a really vague area that we could, that was kind of described by ICANN as generally completing the necessary goalposts that are required in order to, you know, in order to sign a registry agreement, or in order to delegate. Did they go to the PDT? Did they submit their onboarding information? Normally, these are the necessary steps for delegating, and the judgment on behalf of ICANN was always whether or not those steps were completed prior to prior to the applying for the extension. Another aspect to look at is when an extension for the extension for delegation was granted, it wasn't necessarily a 12-month bracket. It was normally a bracket where ICANN believed the applicant could complete the delegation within that time period. Asking whether or not that was enough time for the applicant once they were granted the extension to finish delegation is another area that might be of interest. Okay, let's look at this. But we are at the top of the hour. I'm just going to close this. Jeff, whatever you're typing, I would type it quickly unless you would like to speak it as last-minute words. No?
Yeah, this is Jeff. Sorry. I think it's... this round, last round, was very difficult to make conclusions because of the extremely long delays that were in place. You know, the 4 years between the stopping and starting of the process, people leaving the process, it was really difficult. And so, you know, for example, I could say that some brands that we worked with required extensions to sign the agreement because, as was said, 3 years after they applied, the people that actually wanted the TLD or applied for it were long gone, or some of them actually believed ICANN was going to negotiate contracts, and it took a very long time for ICANN to actually get around to basically saying, no, they're not going to negotiate anything. There's a whole host of reasons why extensions were given, and I think it's really because of the unique set of circumstances. And so I would very strongly caution that we should be very careful in making any conclusions based on what happened in this last round. Thanks.
Thank you, Jeff. And with that, I'm going to leave us with all time to think about that. So join us next week. I think we're going to try to move back to vertical integration again if we can get our data from ICANN. If not, we will be breaking out into the global public interest. All right, this is Michael Feldman checking out and saying, we'll see you next week. Have a good day, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Today's meeting has been adjourned. Please disconnect your lines. And to everyone, have a great day.